This evening, Archbishop of Owen will be in conversation with a member of our Council of the Royal Society of Literature, the award-winning poet and critic Fiona Sampson. Their subject is the language of poetry and faith.
Well, thank you, Colin. Archbishop, if you have recovered from yourself after that tremendous introduction, I know that your original intention was to talk about the different pressures that emerge for religious and poetic language. And I wondered whether we could start, as it were, at the very beginning, with their similarities. I know that, for example, in Grace and Necessity, you talk about the obligation of poetry and indeed writing in general and visual art being to represent the world as it is in itself, a kind of including the possibility of what can't be known by the poet, him or herself, a kind of excess which you associate with grace. And the use of that word grace reminds me, of course, of liturgy, and I wonder really whether this is so different from the project of liturgy, and whether perhaps you feel that in a way what you ask of poetry is the same motion that you ask of liturgy, but in a less specific form.
It's a very good correlation to start with, I think, because it does seem to me that what's going on not only in poetry but actually very generally in human language itself is this impulse to say more than is there. Human language has never, it seems, been narrowly functional, simply descriptive. It's always attempted to rework what's in front of it, not just to reproduce or to reflect, but to rework. And that's why I think both poetry and liturgy are very fundamental human activities. So I think I'd want to connect poetry and ritual in that sense, not just liturgy, but ritual itself. The Neanderthal rubbing ochre on bones is saying something more than he or she has to. And it's the saying more than you have to, which is, to me, the foundation of both these exercises. So coming on to liturgy itself, I think, sadly, one of the mistakes we've often made about liturgy, from the Reformation onwards at least, is imagining that the point of it is to make things clear and to streamline the passage of information, whereas actually what you're looking for is a mode of thinking and speaking that does the equivalent of rubbing the ochre on the bones. It says more than is there, it says more than it has to.
It's not quite just evocation, though, is it?
It's not evocation. It's certainly rooted in the sense that there is more than there is there. And what is presented to the subject, the self, is something that continues to call out a response, a speech, an engagement. So it's not evocation in the sense of trying to find something that presses the right buttons of feeling, but that is genuinely exploratory in some way. It's an interesting thought to me that liturgy has something exploratory about it, that it's...
Thank you.
That it's not just the expression of where we already are. And putting on historian's hat for a moment, one of the most interesting things about the development of liturgical language, formal language in church in the first few centuries of Christianity, is that that's often where the impetus comes from to do theology. People are saying wild and extravagant things when they go to church, and the theologians are catching up, rather belatedly scratching their heads and saying, what's that about?
That's very counterintuitive for a lay audience, because we tend to think that the theologians develop the liturgy.
Now, on the contrary, I think one of the fascinating things you see in some liturgies is kind of archaeological deposits of... ideas that theologians are finding increasingly difficult to cope with, but are just there in the language of worship. So in the 4th century, when all sorts of quite precise doctrinal definitions have been drawn up, the liturgy is still a kind of, well, what would you call it? An archaeological field of archaic and sometimes rather wild elements. Sorry, I've gone like this all night, but let me just give you one example, which I particularly love, and that is the survival in one of the Egyptian liturgies of the imagery for the sun and the Holy Spirit in heaven, drawn from the burning seraphs in the temple in the Old Testament, the great beasts, literally, bellowing at each other in the temple. And you think, it's the Son and the Holy Spirit. It's this theological language, and it's imagined in the liturgy in terms of these monstrous creatures in heaven singing praises echo to one another. Extravagance, you see, and the deposit that runs through even when theologians have been trying to tidy it all up.
You almost seem to be saying that whether you're writing liturgy or you're writing poetry, you both have to be, you have these existential responsibilities, but you also give yourself, or you have some license to be extremely irresponsible and expressive.
I think I'd still go for the word exploratory rather than just expressive. Expressive can be, oh, you know, I've got to get my feelings out there, which I don't think, and I'm sure you don't think, is what poetry is about, or liturgy.
No.
That's the other sort of the other end of the pendulum arc where liturgy is concerned. Either it's too informative or too emotional. Very difficult to get right. But exploratory in the sense of, well, let's try out this rather wild form of phraseology. Let's try out this unexpected turn of phrase, because there's something in all this that we haven't yet got, and by pushing the boundaries we may discover what we never expected. And I think coming to the word pressure, which you used at the beginning, which I hoped we might talk a bit about, the pressure that I'm talking about is exactly that sense of, we're not there yet. And maybe if you pile the pressure on language, you'll discover things. Pile it on by metaphor, pile it on by ritual, pile it on simply by the formal structures of poetry, which oblige you to say things you didn't think you could say.
I think that's enormously interesting, partly because one of the things that always strikes me in your discussions of use of language is that you're very much thinking about the freight of the words, and really they're denotative and quite communal in a sense as a communication community, isn't there? And I wonder about the inner dialogue, what they transform, not when you're rehearsing a poem, but just when you're thinking. And I also wonder about doctrine, which does have to be, in a way, legislative, and how it manages closure, but also the openness of authenticity.
That's a very interesting question, I think, about doctrine. I used sometimes to say to my students when I taught theology in university that you have to think of the history of doctrine as a history of discarded solutions, so that what you end up with is not the perfect formula, but the least stupid thing you can think of saying. So the recipe rather than the cake, to put it in other terms, these are the sorts of things you've got to keep in play when you're talking. But they will keep on shifting. And when you think you've smoothed it out in that area, then you know, the bump comes up somewhere else. So I think that's another aspect of the pressure.
So incompletion and hesitation, a term you use a
hesitation
lot,
is a kind of yes.
Mark of authenticity in a way, a mark of the genuineness of the endeavour.
Hesitation is a word that means quite a lot to me. It has particular resonance in the thought of Simone Weil, who's a very important author for me. And she talks about the hesitation that we ought to feel in the presence of a human other. Whenever we meet someone else, we hesitate. We don't assume we understand them. We have enclosed them, captured them. And I think hesitation in language is one of the ways in which we show that kind of drawing back, that humility, plain English, before what's there. And a humility that's also expectant, because you are looking to deliver more, as I say, more than is apparently there.
So do you think naming is a little bit greedy?
Well, naming is a sort of necessary evil, isn't it? It's or a felix culpa, you know, it's a happy fault. Mm. You've got to do it. And when you've done it, the first thing you ought to think is, now what's wrong with that? Just as I think with any poem, there's a level at which you say, I've got to do it. And the first thing you ought to think when you've got something down on the page is, so what's wrong with that?
That's rather Heideggerian, isn't it? The idea that language falls into authenticity the moment you try and name an experience.
And again, there's a...
Because it's already over, yeah, as it were.
Yeah, and that there is, again, a theological parallel there with the insistence of a lot of the classical tradition that the most serious theological utterance happens when you've more or less run out of things to say.
Perhaps we could slightly shift onto an autobiographical rail then, and I could ask you about the occasions of writing. What prompts you to write a poem or a sermon? Or, I mean, obviously sometimes the occasion, the deadline, but...
Yes, what prompts me to write a sermon is knowing that a service is going
yes.
to start shortly.
Clearly. But, you know, why sometimes a poem and why not? And what's the different... Mm. What does it feel like?
It's extraordinarily difficult to generalise about what generates poetry. I had a lovely visit last week from children from a primary school in Manchester who had, poor things, been reading a poem of mine and wanted to know where I got my ideas, as children do. And I was on that occasion, because of this particular poem, able to tell them exactly the moment at which, during a rather dull lecture, I had spotted a picture on the wall. It was the theological conference. A picture of... picture of the road to Emmaus. And it's something about the figures reminded me of those Wittgensteinian perception things. Is that two profiles or is it a cup sort of thing? And then, all of a sudden, the poem walked in and sat down, as poems occasionally do. And I got a bit of paper out of my... scribbled away furiously as the lecture unfolded. That's a bit unusual, isn't it? I mean, the single occasion. Mm. It's more often, I suppose, an image or a cadence that nags.
But you're quite clear it's going to be a poem. There's no sense of...
Yes, absolutely clear. Because I can sense something stirring in the undergrowth of metaphor. And when I know it's going to work, it's going to need work, I think then I know it's a poem.
Mm.
In a way which is not the case if I'm trying to write a piece of prose. So, yeah, it can be some very, very isolated set of words, some apparently isolated metaphor. And I think one of the things I'm aware of as a failing in myself as somebody who tries to write poetry is quite often I write things that are too much an attempt to make sense of one metaphor.
Yeah.
And it doesn't move enough, it doesn't move forward.
So might we be saying that writing a poem is more exploratory for the poet, but other kinds of writing are potentially more exploratory for their audience or their reader than they are for the person who writes?
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to make too broad a disjunction there. And a poet who's simply doing exploratory stuff for his or her audience is a poet who's not going to find a very wide readership, obviously. You're always trying to lay trails for other people, and one of the rather paradoxical joys of publishing poetry and sharing poetry is, of course, people coming back to you and saying what they think it means, and you think, well, I never thought of that, but hey, the interpretation's welcome. But certainly that's a different exercise from one that is primarily about
conveying an argument or drawing somebody into a discourse, I think.
Mm. As I was reading your pamphlet on the Christian imagination in Poetry and Polity, you quote William Temple, and he talks about the practice of Anglicanism being a leaven in society. I mean, I know that was in the 19th century. Was it the 19th century? 20th century. 20th century. 100 years ago. But still, I wondered whether there is a way in which a writer can see themselves as, you know, in their practice being a leaven within society. And then I wondered whether, no, in your universe, that would be a kind of, would it be a communication community, and would it be socially responsible, or would it be a kind of corruption of the ends of the writing?
I think poetry that sets out to have an improving effect on society is doomed.
I meant as a literary effect, really. Not
yes.
A...
Yeah. clearly one wants to feed something into an ongoing conversation. Yes. Leaven in that sense. And although, obviously, when Auden said poetry makes nothing happen, that's an exaggeration, and sometimes rather toxic exaggeration. But do you see what he means?
Yes.
It's not meant to be propaganda, it's not meant to be instrumental to something else. It is genuinely an offer into the language, a bid into the language, as it were, saying, well, here's this, what do you make of it? And the what do you make of it is a crucial element about it, I think, which is why I don't think it's ever just expressive in the narrower sense. But coming back to the community question, and perhaps relating it a bit to the Welsh background, I'm still very struck by the fact that poetry in Wales remains something that ordinary people talk about in pubs, and people queue up to see the awards at the National Eisteddfod. And there really is a tradition of some strictness, some severity, if you want to work in that sort of vein. Not many cultures, I think, could support a weekly magazine in a minority language which is entirely devoted to classical prosody. But Barthas in Wales does just that, and I'm seriously impressed with that. So that kind of community awareness, which says you'd expect this to be something owned by more than just a few individuals, you'd expect it to be something that that works seriously.
There's
in community.
A comfortable dialogue, isn't there, somehow, between the community's sense of itself and the poets writing in that community, in that language.
That's right. And there are still contexts, again, in parts of Wales, as you know as well as I do, where the ability to improvise an epigram in classical verse is a serious social accomplishment. So if anyone is looking for chat-up lines for West Wales, you have a lot of work to do.
And it works the other way too, doesn't it, in the sense that you talk about the way icons are seen as a channel for the divine, or to come through to the person who contemplates the icon. But there's a sense of, in some poets, of channeling, I don't want to say the zeitgeist because that's so reductive, but being a spokesperson for that sensibility, not in a polemical sense, but simply in a kind of nourished culture sense, the cultural soil they've grown out of.
That's right. And that works in so many different ways, doesn't it? It can work in what is still, if battered, a quite integrated culture like the Welsh classical tradition. It can work at the level that people ascribe to Eliot in the Wasteland, giving voice to the sensibility of a generation. It works terrifyingly in some ways in the recent work of Geoffrey Hill, who, having torn up the lyrical and musical register of a lot of his early and middle work, is writing from, it seems, from inside a deeply broken, deeply angry cultural linguistic crucible.
Yes.
With enormous and very difficult power. So yes, you channel something if you're a certain kind of poet.
I would probably think of late Hill as channeling his own convictions rather than, I mean, he's not normative, is he?
No.
I can safely say.
But there is something about the last five or six collections which because of the bricolage of contemporary reference, because of the very, very deliberate and savagely ironic use of the language of the media sometimes, you can see him shoring fragments.
Yes, I was thinking more of a voice crying in the wilderness, actually.
That too, and I think Eliot's that as well.
I wonder whether your interest in and commitment to translation comes from growing up in a bilingual culture, and indeed home.
Well, I think it does a bit, because back to the point we started with, if you do grow up in a bilingual environment, you're always aware that there's another way of saying things. And I think for a certain kind of child, that's very fascinating. If there's always another way of saying things, then whatever is being pushed at you at any moment as the way to say things, you might think, well, actually, I can't take that for granted.
Did it help that there was a separation between, as it were, the private language of hearth and home and the language of education?
Not a lot, because we did Welsh in school, and my parents tended to speak English to the younger generation, and Welsh to my grandmother and others, so it wasn't quite as straightforward as that. But you certainly become really fascinated by the possible variants of speech. And I think ever since my teenage years, I've been really, really interested by translation, and by the challenge of translation, by this invitation to try and do it again differently.
Yes.
Which is why I think when I've tried to do translations of poetry, I've not followed, we were talking about Nabokov earlier, I've not followed Nabokov's prescription of precise, dry renderings, but trying to think in a way which he rather castigates in his essays on the subject, trying to think, what would this poem be like if it were being written in my language?
Yes, and now. Yes.
Mm. Which is why, and it's a difficult judgment, this, which is why if you're translating strictly metrical and rhymed poems from other cultures, it's very hard to do that in English, because we've become a bit blasé and a bit cynical about that kind of strictness. And so if we did it in that form, it would sound less than it is in its original.
Yes.
So in Russian poetry, for example, where you have such a range of elegant possibilities available in stricter forms, or in Welsh, where you have the internal assonances that thread through everything, then you can see that something immensely powerful can be done in the form. And English verse doesn't quite seem to do it. We hear the da-da-da-da-da-da-da's as boring. And while sometimes it's important to try and do that, just to show it can still be done, and to try and reclaim possibilities, it's a lot harder.
It's a lot harder, isn't it? And maybe that's not entirely to do with our ear, but to do with the difficulties of a mixed-up language. I mean, notoriously, English is a difficult language to rhyme, so a kind of ease and confidence of diction, it's very hard, particularly when it's somebody else's idea, isn't it, that you're re-speaking.
That's right.
It's the Brodsky dilemma, really, isn't
it? It's the Brodsky,
it? He couldn't accept that the formal virtues of his Russian verse couldn't be reproduced.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. It's such a tragedy, really.
Yes.
Whereas others...
Miłosz.
Just the example, yes. He knew the different
The limits
music.
Of English.
the different musics, I think.
Yes. I like very much, though, the idea of, Chakravarti Spivak, who says... She's talking about, obviously translations of complicated theoretical texts, not poetry, difficult challenge, different challenges, but she talks about the obligation of the, what she calls the host language, quite a lot of people use that term, the host language, to be hospitable. In other words, to go the extra length and And make a really good version, make a really good re-speaking of the original.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so the translator has to be perhaps almost disproportionately generous in reading.
Yes.
Which may sometimes mean that a translator can end up producing a poem that's really more interesting in the translation than the original. But at best, I think, again, looks for the what isn't there and tries to draw that in as best he or she can.
You wouldn't have any of your own translations of Welsh poetry here, would you?
Here's one I made earlier. I think I might have something. Just a moment. Well, actually, here's an example of trying to do precisely the rendering into a strict English form of a strict Welsh one. It's a sonnet by David Gwenallt Jones, who was one of the great poets of mid-20th century Wales. And he wrote this sonnet, I think, in the 40s at some point. Very strict in Welsh, with lots of these maddeningly unrenderable assonances and so forth. It's called Sin. But I found it was so tight and elegant in the Welsh that I really wanted to have a go at putting it into something tight and elegant in English, and I don't know whether I succeeded, but take off the business suit, the old school tie, the gown, the cap, drop the reviews, awards, certificates, stand naked in your sty, a little carnivore, clothed in dried turds. The snot that slowly fills our passages seeps up from hollows where the dead beasts lie. Dumb stamping dances spell our messages. We only know what makes our arrows fly. Lost in the wood, we sometimes glimpse the sky between the branches, and the words drop down we cannot hear. The alien voices, high and hard, singing salvation, grace, life, dawn. Like wolves, we lift our snouts. Blood, blood, we cry. The blood that bought us so we need not die.
Thank you.
But that, compared with the final line in the Welsh, an Ido am a gwaed yn prynodd mi, which is so kind of Ido howling for the blood that bought us, Ido am a gwaed yn prynodd mi. I think it's one of the great lines of modern Welsh poetry and one of the most uncompromising.
That love of the sound of language makes me think about that, returning to that that idea of truth breaking through. You know, Julia Kristeva talks about, she's not the only person to separate the meaning and the sound from the language, but since she was also an analyst, she talks about the way we hesitate and stammer and become more musical and fall away from strict meaning when we get closer to something that matters to us.
Yes, yes. Yes, that's right. And you mentioned incompletion earlier on, which I think is very important here. Again, another Auden's dicta, that a poem is never finished, only abandoned. I resonate a lot with that. Because the balance between getting the right kind of elegance and the right kind of unfinishedness, the right kind of respect and hesitation, is, I suppose, the challenge for anyone who's seriously trying to write poetry. Rounding it off too tightly is going to be a disaster. Geoffrey Hill, again, writing about Antony and Cleopatra and pointing out the extraordinary effect of our soldier standing alone in Cleopatra's final speeches over Antony's body. Mm. Or the amazing effect in some of George Herbert's poems of the abrupt endings, the half lines,
yes,
and the deliberate fracture of what is in Herbert very often a very elegant and beautiful register and rhetoric.
Do you think we're reaching for that too when we use understatement?
Surely, surely. Again, writing in English which has a bit of a name for understatement, the temptation is to reach for that, perhaps, rather than the other kinds of excess. Sometimes we need to be embarrassed, I suspect, by the more obvious sorts of excess, and not always reach for understatement. But again, it's a nice distinction, isn't it?
Yes. Mm. I suppose another of those excesses is overt musicality, coming back to the dilemma of a strict meter. And one of the things that fascinates me in your thought is that you are very interested in time and space. Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about our formation in time. Mm. You're very... It's quite central to your thinking, isn't it? This kind of unfolding through time. Mm. And it reminds me, in a funny way, of... You know Goethe's idea that architecture is frozen music. Mm. And that idea, I always release this one into the idea that music and poetry then can be temporal architecture. They can be abstract forms enacted through time, which is obviously comes back to ritual and the proximity of poetry to ritual.
Very much so. It's relating it back to icons once again. It's about with architecture, with the icon, how is the eye led? What is the journey that you're expected to take here? Mm. Because the point of the architecture, the point of the icon, is that you do not stand still and kind of click the image. You follow something out. And in that sense, of course, music and poetry are doing exactly that. Mm. And I guess anybody writing poetry would say the real question is, where's it going? How's it going? How's it moving?
Mm.
Where is your ear being led?
Mm.
And leading the ear, of course, happens at so many different levels. The levels where you discover an assonance, an echo, you'd barely noticed, but it suddenly becomes part of the journey, it becomes part of what carries you through. And that, to me, is one of the most interesting things, interesting and often unplanned things about poetry, that you realise you are somehow listening in, and your ear is leading you subconsciously, giving you things to hang the argument, the progression on.
And is that because we need to pattern make? We need to...
Certainly, we need to pattern make. We need, in the widest possible sense, rhythm. We, as physical beings, we are rhythmical.
Mm.
Our hearts beat.
Mm.
And our breath comes in, and our breath goes out. And we underrate that basic fact at our peril, I think. Our language, one way and another, comes back to those fundamentals. The stress, the unstress, the indrawn, the outgoing. Meditative techniques work with heartbeat and breath. Anyone who's practiced contemplation in certain traditions will know that's a fundamental, the attention to that. Not surprising, then, if patterning of that kind comes through in poetry.
Yes, and it's in perhaps in language in general. I mean, the breath, the kind of, you know, the wave and the fetch.
Isn't that interesting? Yes, yes.
And both and semantically and physically.
And you can tell so often a prose that has, not my poetry, a prose that has not been through that listening process.
Although I tend to think that a grammatical phrasal unit is just about the length of a breath.
Mm.
You know, subject, object, verb. Mm.
Yep.
Subject, object, verb.
That's right. And those of us who grew up with the old Book of Common Prayer know that there's really quite a lot of attention to breath units there.
Yes.
It's a different exercise, speaking the text of the Book of Common Prayer, but because of that.
Yes, and there's wonderful elastic phrases in the Psalms where you learn, your ear learns about parallelism and about, statement and response. The caesura in the middle, but you know, you learn as a child that actually some phrases are a lot longer than others, and you're going to stick on one note for a very long time before you arrive at a...
But that's a good point, isn't it, about parallelism? Because once again, in the Psalms, you have that vital sense, there's more than one way of saying this. Let's toss it backwards and forwards.
And indeed in common prayer.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Cranmer, just hanging the extra two words on. And always, as it were, saying, you could put this another way, very Anglican. But the pairing of words, the tripling of words, which slows things down, which, as I think I once put it, allows you to hover a bit over the semantic territory. You don't absolutely have to settle.
It's also staging assent, isn't it, when the priest says something and the congregation says it back. When I was a child, it used to make me laugh because I used to think it was a failure of invention on the part of the grown-ups that they hadn't found something new to say.
Yes, yes. But
does common prayer remind us of the sort of tax of the problem of the old legacy of beauty of holiness and the problem of, you know, beauty can't be an end in itself?
Beauty can't be an end in itself, and that is the absolute dilemma, I think, that a lot of modern Christians face. It's too easy to run for the comfort of what's familiarly beautiful and think it must be holy because it's familiarly beautiful. And yet, very often what we end up with isn't, as it were, creatively shocking or creatively excessive. It's just a bit flat. So we're in a very strange period for liturgical language, and it's something to do with the fact that we haven't got much of a public register for solemn language anyway. I don't know what you think, but I suspect sometimes it's one of the differences between this country and the United States, where a President Obama can still get away with...
Plenty of parallelism, actually.
Plenty of parallelism and the high tone.
Yes.
And when we hear that, we laugh it off.
Yes, I always worry that, you know, demystifying moves away from authority, actually, certainty.
It's more, well, demystifying seems to me a perfectly proper exercise when it's part of the liberating moment when you think someone else mustn't be allowed to get away with their closures without some questions. It becomes really poisonous and negative, I think, when it's simply a matter of saying everything is concealing something which I need to know and I must know, and it's being concealed for corrupt reasons. And that's a question about our media culture, it's a question about our linguistic culture generally. And what moves me, I think, about serious poetry is that it's always an attempt not to re-mystify, but to reintroduce a sense that a mystery is not a corruptly protected secret. It's an invitation. It's an agony of pressure to discover something which you will never discover and never exhaust.
Maybe the greatest pressure on language at the moment, then, is the pressure to be universal.
I think that's right. I think that the sheer diversity of language is, again, one of those fundamentally human things which we lose at our peril. If you think that languages don't multiply but reduce over cultural history, that in, 1,000 years ago, there would have been lots of different languages spoken in what we now think of as the English linguistic area, all variants of, as we would now say, variants of English, as if they were all automatically moving towards the great satisfying climax of turning into modern English. But I think if you'd been speaking West Midland dialect in the 9th century, you wouldn't have thought, oh good, this is on the way to modern English. You'd have thought, I'm speaking, I'm just doing it. And the more languages disappear, the worse it is for that, again, that very profound, basic human sense that there's more than one way of doing this. And the attempt to regard the benchmark as functionalized, efficient, descriptive language, the bureaucratization of language, that really is something deeply bad for us.
So really, to sum up, as it were, what you're saying is perhaps in an Augustinian way that we need to write humanly.
I'm always happy to be Augustinian, as you know. Yes, write humanly, and that means writing with the awareness that there will be other ways of saying this, with the awareness that you haven't finished what you have to say about it, because somebody else will say something and that becomes part of what you then need to say and respond to. Saying it within conversation, within the ongoing shared life, all of that, I'd say. And for those who may not recognize the allusion, it's Augustine's wonderful statement in, I think it's book 4 of the Confessions, isn't it, where he's talking about loving humanly and his failure in love as an obsessive teenager looking for intense emotional experiences. He says, I wasn't loving humanly. I didn't love other people as human beings. I loved them as, you know, fantasies contained within my own mind, satisfying my own agenda. And to love somebody humanly means to love them in their limits and to love them in their mortality. And writing humanly, I suppose, is writing with those limits and that mortality in mind, not as something that's somber and limiting and sort of closing in, but on the contrary, something which says, well, when you've come to the end, somehow you haven't.
Thank you so much, Archbishop. His Grace will now take questions for Court of an Hour, and Colin Subwin is going to chair those.
Given the limitations of time, perhaps we can confine the questions to the topic addressed this evening, poetry and faith. Yes.
First of all, as a Welsh woman...
You have a mic.
First of all, as a Welsh woman, I'd like to say diolch yn fawr iawn, which is thank you very much indeed, both of you. I've listened to what you've said about the freight of words and in and out and what we do when we write, and my question is this. When we write, are we gathering in or letting go? Are we remembering or forgetting?
Gosh. How very interesting. Forgetting in the sense that I think every time you make a choice in a poem about words and phrasing, you are, of course, pushing something away. A good poem, perhaps like a good work of visual art, like a good theological utterance, reminds you of what you've chosen to forget in writing it. It reminds you of the other, the shadow possibility. And I think that's one of the fascinating things about poetry in strict form, that because if you're looking at verses, you always think, well, what else might have gone there? And you know this is the journey you've chosen to take, and it's shadowed by something else, by other possibilities. So drawing in and letting go, there are times when I guess both of those feel like what you're doing, not so. There's a drawing in the sense that you are trying to plait something together. There's a letting go, which is absolutely necessary, in saying, I don't yet know where this is going, and I'm not prepared to foreclose. What do you think, Fiona?
Well, I'm sure you're right that both, actually, the kind of to and fro, isn't that part of the movement
we were talking about in poetry?
And it's both, isn't it? Because I mean, it's that funny word writing, which means both the text that other people read and the verb of doing it. So it's a push-me-pull-you, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Your Grace, I had the privilege of watching Ina Lisnyanskaya read and take in one of your translations of her poems, and of hearing her, through her daughter who was interpreting, react to your what you made of her poem, and she was very, very pleased and very touched.
Good.
But what I'd like to ask you is, could you say something about when a translator, albeit with a generous reading, produces something which is effectively the work of the poet that he's translated, as opposed to producing his own poem? Because I've read both your translations and your own poems, and there is a great distinction there, although it's your ear that's doing the listening. Is it possible for you to address that, please?
I think I'd go back to this question of how does it move. I've had the rather odd experience too of reading my poems in translation, including Russian translation, believe it or not, and Italian. And what makes you recognise them is knowing that the story is the same. You can see how image leads to image and echo leads to echo, not in the same verbal way, but it's got the same integrity of shape and movement. And I think that's the absolute bare minimum that a faithful translator has to stick to. You mustn't muck around with the way it's moving. You mustn't change the story. En route, you can perhaps boldly decide, well, maybe another kind of metaphor might work better in English at that point. Maybe the resonances there would be better caught by something a bit more like this. And I once wrote a little piece on the experience of translating one of the great Welsh poems of the last century, Mewn Dau Gai by Waldo Williams, and trying to explain why I'd made some of the choices I had, because it seemed that a word that carried this little range of resonances in Welsh wouldn't, if you translated it straightforwardly, carry the same in English. So for the sake of the integrity of the whole thing, you had to find something a little bit different. But that's the bare minimum. I think if you change the story, you're not quite translating any longer.
There was somebody right up at the back there.
Yes.
Hello. You spoke about Geoffrey Hill. I was wondering where you saw your own poetics of faith and doubt falling in step with or diverging from Hill's idea of atonement, as in his pun, a form of atonement, reconciling things, doubts, ambiguities on the page.
Thank you. I have to say Geoffrey Hill is one of the writers I'm most engaged by and most admire, and I'm sometimes baffled and stretched by. But his great sort of iconic piece on atonement, atonement, was for me, when I first read it decades ago, a really very, very significant discovery. It's where he picks up the language that Eliot and Auden and Yeats all use about things coming together, the click of something coming together in words, and how important that is, the sense that you know, yes, this has come home, but precisely not in a way that then absolves you from the unfinishedness that follows. So, yeah, and I can only put on record my enormous debt to Geoffrey Hill and the amazing complexity and variety of the work that he's produced in prose as well as in poetry. And what he's written on the poetics of faith is something I find deeply sympathetic, yes.
Yes. That's the gentleman over there. Yes.
Could you say something about joy in poetry? Because I have to say, I got a bit depressed listening to it. Sound, a lot of what you said was very epistemological and tentative, and even the word exploratory, I started to worry about poetry. Could you say something about joy, particularly in terms of your parallels with liturgy?
Oh, right, yes.
I don't mean that cynically, but I felt one aspect of poetry is being missed out here. I'm a teacher, and I think trying to convey what you said to children tonight would be quite frightening.
Dear. Yes. I'm reminded of a wonderful television interview many years ago with a Welsh farmer who was complaining about some hippies on his land, and he said, "The trouble with these people is they think life is fun." So what you may be getting is perhaps a little bit of ancestral Celtic gloom. But what about joy? Well, I think I don't regard exploratory as a negative word or a shadowed word. It's a risky word, but in my own lexicon, it's really a rather exciting word. And that you never quite know what's coming up in poetry is a wonderful thing about it. And if I were talking, have occasionally talked to school children about this, I'd want to start there. This is actually watching words that you might have thought sat dully on the page, getting up and dancing, and sometimes dancing in a most undignified and unexpected manner. And although we've talked quite a bit about rather somber poets from time to time, Geoffrey Hill is a case in point. One of my greatest enthusiasms among more recent poets is Dorothy Nimmo, whose work may not be known to many of you, but I think as a not comedic poet, but as a poet who is constantly teasing and playing around, joking with words, punning. Wonderful, exhilarating stuff. And isn't this what most of us really do find we go back to in the great poets? It's not just the sense of struggle. I entirely take their approach, and I know, you know, it's a temperamental thing. I will always go on about struggle given the chance. But what we go back to, what we treasure, even in an Eliot, is, yes, joy, if you like, which doesn't mean jollity necessarily, but why is it that a lyric like "The Dove Descending Breaks the Air" is something that's still kind of stills you, opens up, and also terrifies. You ought to worry about poetry, you know, it's no bad thing at all. But yes, you're absolutely right, it would be a really stupid account of poetry that did not give full weight to that element of exhilaration that comes to it. The excess is there too, in that, I think.
Sadly, we just have time for one more question. There are so many. Perhaps the lady at the back, who was the first person to put up her hand in white. Sorry to all the others.
I wanted to ask something about the project of Theopoetics. I've been reading some Catherine Keller recently, and wondered, you know, where... I find it personally quite hypnotic, and I just wondered whether you felt the language coming together in those kind of projects sort of... well, what you thought of it. Catherine Keller or Ruben Alves or...
Sorry,
Ruben Alves, I think, is also someone.
Yes. Slightly mixed feelings, I suppose, because I'm going to get gloomy again now, because I don't want it to be too rhapsodic too quickly. I want to hang on to the unfinished business and the modesty that I think poetry has to search for. But I'm not as familiar as you are with this, so... I think I'd need to go back and put a towel around my head and think about it further, really.
All right, one last one. The lady at the end, in the middle. In the green hat.
Sorry.
Your Grace, as no doubt you remember, that Thomas Hardy described poetry and religious as one touches another. Most poets I know, especially great poets, are split between wanting to be a religious person, a saint, and wanting to be a poet. Can a poet be a saint? Or according to Marina Tsvetaeva, all poets are heretics by definition of the nature of art. Do you have this division in you?
There's no very good answer to that. But just a couple of thoughts on that. All poets are heretics by nature. Well, in the sense that no serious poet simply takes for granted what is there, but is always asking, how do I get inside the life of language and move it forward? The trouble is, heretic is almost a debased word for us. We just think it means somebody who is boldly defying boring orthodoxies. As somebody who is a Christian doesn't find orthodoxy at all boring, quite the contrary, I don't want to be a heretic in that sense. But as for poetry and sanctity, there's a big question, isn't there, always about any artist and holiness, what we mean by holiness. And there's all the clichés about perfection of the life and of the work, which I don't entirely buy into, because it's often used as an alibi by people who know perfectly well their life is an unmanageable mess and therefore think their work must be wonderful. But I think I would want to say that there are not two completely detached things going on here. To try to write as a believer, if I can be very personal, is to try and find words that I hope will have something of the same transparency to the truth or to grace that I would long for and pray for in my life. I don't think they're two different things. If the point is somehow along the way to arrive at something that is translucent to that more, that unsaid, in life or in speech, that's the purpose of it all. So I think that a George Herbert is always possible. You know, someone who, in the eyes of his contemporaries, is translucent in both ways, from both perspectives. But speaking of somebody who is emphatically not George Herbert, it is also hard work. And not something that comes simply. And because writing is always something where you have to watch the runaway ego almost as much as you have to do in prayer. You know, you're aware of the temptations at both ends. Sorry, I would go on. Thank you for the question.
It remains for me simply on your behalf to thank His Grace the Archbishop of Canterbury for what is a wonderfully subtle and thought-provoking exposition, and to thank Fiona Sampson for eliciting it. I think I'm speaking for all of us, Your Grace, when I say that in what admiration and even affection we who, I suppose, work in what's still called the humanities hold you. And you've certainly earned tremendous admiration and respect and gratitude this evening. Thank you so much.